Illinois has been without a budget for 20 months, and after yesterday, we don't know if there's an end in sight.
My only hope is that it's sooner rather than later, because as you all know, we are looking at going in the hole $11 million a day. Every single day, we don't get this solved.
That's Republican leader Christine Rodonio on the Senate floor yesterday. Today, we talk about the collapse of the grand bargain with WICS political reporter Jordan Abadea and Civic Federation President Lawrence Massal. La Vida Baseball is a new digital magazine that just launched, and editor-in-chief Adrian Burgos Jr., a University of Illinois baseball historian, joins us. And with temperatures dipping back below freezing tonight throughout the state, what's the forecast for early blooming plants confused by the weather that are already popping above ground? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. Welcome. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about the Senate's grand bargain compromise falling apart yesterday, what that means next. But there's some breaking news we have this morning from Peoria. Federal officials are, as we speak, executing a search warrant at three Caterpillar facilities, including its Peoria headquarters. Joining us now is the Peoria Journal Star's Chris Gerhard to tell us more. Hey, Chris, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here. Chris? Looks like we're having a hard time getting a hold of Chris. We're just going to get that there. There's been some breaking news this morning, some reports about, as I said, federal authorities that are executing a search warrant at three different Caterpillar facilities. From what we know, Chris Kerrigard is going to join us in a minute. This is a developing story. I have heard also from one Caterpillar employee this morning also just about perhaps this being a Securities and Exchange Commission investigation. There's a couple other reports. Let's see if we can get Chris back on the line. Chris, are you there?
I am here.
Hey, Chris. So, you know, this is a story that's just broken in the past hour or so. What do we know? What federal authorities are involved?
We know so far from what we've seen down at the scene that authorities from the IRS, the FDIC, and U.S. Department of Commerce agency, the Bureau of Industry and Security, Office of Export Enforcement, are on the scene. There may also be state and federal authorities who are there, and they're searching three facilities or facilities in three communities in Peoria, East Peoria, and Morton.
I heard from one Caterpillar employee this morning that the Securities and Exchange Commission is involved. Has anyone verified that yet, Chris?
We have not yet, though we have heard from employees who are in the building that some people who work in both in the accounting and tax departments have been asked to hold in the cafeteria area of the building. If that's the case, then those would be the type of people that SEC officials might wish to talk to or not have at their desks while they're conducting a search.
Obviously, this is a breaking story, so there's a lot we don't know. What has Caterpillar said?
Caterpillar has been very terse in what they have said. They released a statement simply acknowledging that there was a search underway at multiple facilities in the area and that they are cooperating with the search, and they've declined to say anything else at this point about it.
At this point, do you have a sense of what this may be about? We just know what agencies are involved.
Yeah, at this point, that's really all we know for certain. We know that as a Fortune 100 company, Caterpillar is subject to a number of inquiries, investigations, lawsuits, et cetera, including some that have related in the past to tax-related issues. So whether this relates to those or not, we really can't say at this point. It's all fairly murky still at this stage of the game.
Well, it's a developing story. Thanks to the Peoria Journal Star's Chris Kerrigard for joining us. Chris, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll have more information, of course, as this story is developing throughout the day. Stay tuned to this public radio station for the latest news on that Caterpillar story. Moving on to other news, last night the state Senate was getting ready to vote on a series of bills as part of a so-called grand bargain that could finally put an end to Illinois' 20-month-long budget crisis. But it fell apart when Senate Republicans told Senate President John Cullerton they weren't ready to vote on this. Joining us from Springfield to talk about this is WICS news reporter, News Channel 20 reporter Jordan Abadea, and from Chicago, Civic Federation President Lawrence Massal. Jordan, Lawrence, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Let's start with just playing some audio. State Senator Christine Rodonio spoke on the floor yesterday. Obviously, one of the leaders, she worked with Senate President, or her counterpart, John Cullerton, to put together this quote-unquote grand bargain. Here's what she had to say.
I just want to say that this experience has been at once both one of the most frustrating but rewarding experiences in the 20 years that I've been here. Our state is suffering so badly right now, and I know how many of us in this chamber, I think almost without exception, want us to get the budget together so that we can move forward. To a person, the people that I have spoken with have been sincere, honest, willing to compromise, and with that kind of an attitude in this chamber, I have no question in my mind that we're going to bring this thing in for a landing. My only hope is that it's sooner rather than later, because as you all know, we are looking at going in the hole $11 million a day, every single day. We don't get this solved. So I think there's enough goodwill in this building. I know the governor will be joining us in trying to get that done, but we need to get it done and done soon.
That's Christine Rodonio, Senator Christine Rodonio, on the floor yesterday. One of the leaders, of course, behind this. Lawrence, do you have a sense? Do you think that this is going to actually happen? She says there's enough goodwill to get it done. What do you think?
Well, I think everyone is hoping that the Senate will figure out a way to move forward with what they call their grand bargain. Senator Rodonio is absolutely right. Anybody who cares to look at the situation views it as untenable. The fact that Illinois is the only state among the 50 that is attempting to operate now for almost 20 months without a budget is both very expensive but also very reckless. We're doing a lot of damage to our major institutions, higher education, the universities, community colleges, because not having a budget is not the same as not spending money. The state's spending much more money and incurring more obligations than it has the ability to pay.
Let's get into the politics a little bit of this for a minute before we get to, because Lawrence, I do want to talk to you about all of that, the implications, the actual policy behind how we can solve this. But Jordan, can we just talk about what led to, we were on track yesterday afternoon to vote. Can you just kind of walk us through what happened?
So on Tuesday, we had started to vote on some of these bills. The senators had started to take them up. We heard Minority Leader Christine Rodonio a few weeks back say, you know, by the end of this month, we want to start moving forward on these bills. So she kind of put the timeline on this, and she's done this before, and they had passed up that timeline a couple times before. And so they had started to vote on some of what, you know, a lot of people were calling the low-hanging fruit of this package, procurement reform, things that are easy that both sides could eventually come to some kind of terms on. They did bring up pension reform on that Tuesday, which is not a low-hanging fruit in any terms. And that bill actually failed for the second time to get enough votes. And so they said, we still have some things to do. Senate President John Cullerton asked to put that on postponed consideration so that they could vote on that bill again. And word was they were going to go back and negotiate the final terms of some of these harder bills, the revenue portion, the workers' comp portion, the school funding reform bill, and that they were going to come back and vote the next day. We walked into the Capitol on Wednesday. The plan was they were going to go to caucus, talk about these plans in their caucus meetings, and then come back and start voting on them. And then the schedule kind of got turned upside down, and, you know, they started going to committees first, and they weren't exactly ready. And that happens at the Capitol because then that means negotiations are still going on. People are still talking. Legislation might still be being tweaked or amendments might still be written. But, you know, by the time it was around 5:30, that both leaders came to the floor and we thought, okay, this is going to happen. We're going to hear a vote now. It was, nope, we don't have the support from the Republican Party. We can't move forward on this. This has to be bipartisan. And a lot of people will say, well, Senate President John Cullerton has a supermajority. He could just pass these bills on his own. But this is not something Democrats want to do on their own. They were getting very stiff opposition from the union, which is a big backer of their party, on the pension reform and some of the other bills, the workers' compensation reform, some of those things. And so these were tough votes on both sides of the aisle. This isn't something that's easy for either Democrats or Republicans to pass. And Democrats said that the governor ended up interjecting himself and putting pressure on Republicans not to vote for this bill. And so it seems right now that he's getting a lot of the blame, even though Republicans are saying it wasn't him. This bill is just not ready. That bill's not ready. There are certain parts of this that aren't ready for a vote. But at some point, a bill has to be ready for a vote because you can continue talking about it until the end of session and we're back where we started.
Right, Jordan, I just want to talk about that, about blaming Governor Rauner for undermining this. I know that you all just talked to Governor Rauner. What did he have to say about all of that?
The governor, to the public, has been very optimistic about this deal. He said he wanted to stay out of it. I don't think that he was staying out of it as much as people had wanted to, according to sources. You know, Republicans were talking to the governor, weeks and weeks ago. He did come out publicly during his budget address and said, these are my parameters, and he kind of moved the goalposts a little bit. I think Minority Leader Christine Rodonio and Senate President John Cullerton were working on a deal what they thought they could get each caucus to support, and when the governor came in and moved the goalposts, I think it shook a lot of Republicans to say, nope, this isn't a good deal. We can't support this. And it's very hard for Republicans to support things like tax increases and things like that. So if you're going to wait 2 years to say that we need these reforms, we need to make the state more business friendly, those reforms have got to be substantial then, because we've waited 2 years for them. And I think the governor and Republicans don't think that the reforms in this grant bargain were substantial enough at this point.
It's an interesting of the timing of it, though, to get through halfway voting some of it and then sort of pull the plug in the middle. Any word as to why it would have happened at that point?
That's what Democrats are pointing to show that the governor threatened Republicans. I think it was just that, you know, the low-hanging fruit of the bill were easy to vote on. And I think, you know, at the Capitol, things move very quickly, and people probably thought that this package was going to be negotiated further and worked on. And I think, you know, as Republicans started talking amongst themselves and probably talking to the governor, they realized that they didn't want to put their names to votes that were, you know, even more difficult and not something that the governor was happy with. And so that's the point we're at now. Things have completely stopped and we're pretty much back at square one.
So News Channel 20 WICS's Jordan Abadea with us, along with Civic Federation President Lawrence Massal. Lawrence, how much of this impasse is about politics versus policy?
I think they're it's intertwined quite a bit in the case of Illinois, and it's really pointing to really the difficulty that the difficult path Illinois is on. Because we didn't get a budget 2 years ago, a balanced budget, we're now negotiating over all sorts of reforms that may or may not be attractive to different voting blocks within the Illinois Senate. And one of the other challenges, because we've let our unpaid bills rise to such an extraordinary level, by recent accounts as much as almost $14 billion by the end of this fiscal year, we're not talking about a tax increase that's going to be used to pay for new projects, new programs, new spending by the state of Illinois. The tax increase has already been spent, in effect, because we have this enormous amount of unpaid bills. We have this worst-in-the-nation credit rating. That's also tied to not having a budget, but basically it means we pay in Illinois a much higher price for borrowing. So the members of the General Assembly and the governor are faced with the reality that they have to raise taxes just to pay for the expenses that they've incurred over the last 2 years. They don't have anything to offer the citizens to say, look at the new program, look at the new solution, look at the new infrastructure bridge or road that you're getting because of the tax increase, because it's not there. We've already spent the money. The politics of this are also that even though there's a supermajority in the Senate, there's not enough support among the Senate Democrats to pass a tax increase. If they had wanted to pass a tax increase or at least keep the tax increase, the chance was there when the temporary income tax increase was set to expire. The shame for Illinois was that the temporary income tax increase, although it helped improve the pension funding in some other areas of state government, it wasn't enough, and it wasn't tied to a plan that really allowed the state to go on in a reasonable way once the temporary income tax expired. Now we're talking about everything but the kitchen sink in terms of what different constituents want, whether it's casino gambling expansions, workers' comp reform, pension reform, many important things that could be beneficial to Illinois. But it's a lot to put on the table to keep everybody in agreement that there's 30 members in the Senate and 60 in the House that support what it is. And so this is a very dangerous time for Illinois. We're entering into the end of the first quarter, March, and that means the retroactive tax increase, this grand bargain had income taxes going back up to 4.99% for individuals and 7% for businesses, which means that the withholding that those businesses and individuals were allocating was not going to be sufficient without a big increase. That's not very...
Yeah, I want to get into that in a few minutes. We just have about a minute before the break. And so, Jordan, I know we were going to let you go before the break. I just want to ask you, what happens next? What happened to Lawrence is talking about gambling, all of these other bills that were passed? Is that all moot? Where do we go from here?
So all of the bills, the way they're written right now, are connected. So if one of them doesn't pass, then the entire package falls apart. So right now, they're not moving forward because they're connected to all these other tougher pieces of legislation that never got a vote. And so right now it's a waiting pattern. I did ask the Senate president last night, what are the next steps? And he really put the ball in Governor Rauner's court. He said, well, the governor squashed this deal that we're working on, so it's really up to him. It's up to him to decide what he wants a compromise to look like. We're going to keep talking. I'm open to hearing more suggestions. But at this point, it's up to the governor to decide what he thinks negotiations should look like.
Jordan, in about 20 seconds, do we know what Governor Rauner's been saying about this?
Governor Rauner sent a statement yesterday saying he appreciates the Senate's concerns, but he has to make sure that the deal is good for taxpayers and the state alike. And so he said that he hopes they continue negotiations.
That's WICS News Channel 20's Jordan Abadea from Springfield. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Lawrence Massal, talking a little bit more about the policy of it. Thanks, Jordan. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. We've been talking about the politics of the collapse of what we've seen so far, the so-called grand bargain this week in the Springfield, in the State House, that would have put an end to Illinois' 20-month-long budget crisis. I want to talk about the actual substance of what was discussed this week, with the hope that some of these ideas perhaps will be a framework to at some point actually resolving this budget situation. My guest is a Civic Federation president, Lawrence Massal, who's on the line with us from Chicago. Lawrence, you mentioned a couple of different things. We were talking about the temporary tax increase. We were talking about tax increases before the break. Let's talk about the revenue, because it seems like that's where the hangups are right now, right? I mean, I think it seems like maybe we have some sort of compromise on the spending side, but can we talk about where we are on the revenue side of things, what the state needs to do in terms of what lawmakers have proposed, whether we're talking about personal income tax or retirement income? Maybe we should go through those individually. Let's start with personal income taxes. Where are we at with that?
Well, so right now, the current personal income tax is 3.75%. Under the Senate grand bargain plan, it would go to 4.99%. For individuals, that would be expected to raise an additional $4.6 billion for the state of Illinois. The plan also raises the corporate income tax from 5% to 7% for businesses, and that would raise another $577 million. So there, right there, you're talking about $5.2 billion in new revenue, but that new revenue won't be available this year unless it's retroactive to January 1st. So that's why there's so much time pressure on the revenue side, that if there's going to be a grand bargain, you need to address it early in the this quarter. We're running
right, because we can't really hit people. So what you're saying is we can't really hit people with a 5% tax retroactively.
Exactly. You can do it, you know, for a month or two. People can adjust their withholdings, and it's not too much of a burden. But if you enter into the second or third quarter of the year, then people basically have to double their withholdings. And although it can still be done from a mechanical standpoint, it's very politically unpopular and will bring even greater resentment on the tax increase.
So is your sense now, Lawrence, that do you think that option is over? What is your sense?
No, but it's getting our sense would be that option is quickly – that window is closing. And so that was one of the reasons why Senator Redonio said February 28th to get this established before the end of the first quarter. There's still 28 days left in March that would allow them to take up the grand bargain and maybe make it retroactive. But they would be cutting it very close.
When we're looking at other taxes, we've heard discussion about retirement income and property taxes. Where are you seeing those discussions going?
Well, the governor has said that he doesn't support the tax on retirement income, and even though that was floated and the Civic Federation has supported, it was not part of the grand bargain. The tax on retirement income would bring Illinois in line with all the other states that have income taxes and all the surrounding states, such as Indiana, Wisconsin, Missouri, that tax some portion of your retirement income, and the federal government, which taxes retirement income. It's a very generous exemption that Illinois has, where we exempt all retirement income from state taxation, and it's worth over $2 billion in revenue to the state. It's not that we want to tax people as they enter the retirement stage. It's just that the state has run up so many unpaid bills, almost $14 billion by the end of this year, that we can't afford not to share the burden among the retirement income. And our exemption that the Civic Federation recommended, tied to the federal government, would be that if Social Security is your only income, you would pay no state income tax on it, just like you don't at the federal level. But at a certain point, once your income rose above the federal qualifying amount, you would pay the same in proportionally to the state income tax.
Well, we're thinking about
Go
ahead.
So the grand bargain also proposed expanding the sales tax on services to include repair and maintenance, amusement tax tickets, landscaping, dry cleaning, vehicle storage, and some other things. That we think makes sense for both state and local governments because it's expanding the base. In fact, the Civic Federation has proposed that you could expand the sales tax on services and reduce the actual rate that people pay for sales tax, and which would be very advantageous in our larger cities, especially Chicago, where we have the highest sales tax in the United States.
That said, Lawrence, now we're at March 2nd. We don't have what we thought we had 24 hours ago, which seems to kind of be the story of the state of Illinois and the fiscal crisis that we're in. What do you want to see happen in the next coming days?
Well, I'd like to see a serious counteroffer to come forward from the governor and the Republicans in terms of what they need to have as part of the grand bargain so that we can actually deal in specifics. Everything should be balanced so that we're actually, if we're going to raise taxes, if we're going to address our budget situation, that it should be something that actually moves the state forward. But the most important thing the Civic Federation would like to see is a commitment to actually having a budget, because that's something that with this grand bargain failing, not only do we not get the increased revenues and we don't get the reforms in procurement, some of the other things that strongly are supported, but we don't get a budget, which means we don't have the ability to control our obligations and we continue to dig the hole deeper.
That's the Civic Federation's president, Lawrence Missal, on the ongoing budget impasse situation. Lawrence, thanks for being with me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity.
This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With all the warm weather we had last week, many people may be noticing the perennials in their garden beginning to emerge. I know I have in my front yard. But with the freezing cold temperatures we're expecting tonight throughout most of the state, especially in central Illinois, we're looking at light rain, maybe snow showers, temperatures of about 20 degrees. What's going to happen with these plants? To get these questions and more, we're joined now by two horticulture educators with the University of Illinois Extension. Martha Smith is on the line with us from Milan near the Quad Cities. And on the line from Havana, about 45 miles southwest of Peoria, is Rhonda Ferry. Martha, Rhonda, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Martha, I noticed that the tulips in my front yard are already growing a few inches above the ground already. Is that unusual for March 2nd?
In our part of the state, you know, usually we're, you know, having cold weather, usually March comes in like a lion, and it certainly didn't this year. It's not unusual because they're just responding to the temperature. But they're tough. They'll make it through. But it happens, you know, pretty much every couple years, and I'm really not all that concerned unless they get up to a blooming stage. Then we might have some issues.
Rhonda, is there something that I should be doing to protect them from the frost tonight, or as Martha says, they're probably going to be okay?
No, I'm with Martha. I think that at this point, most of the plants are at a stage that aren't going to have significant damage. I mean, even if they have a little bit of, if their leaves are out more than usual, they may be nipped just a little, but it's not going to affect them long term. It's probably not going to take the whole leaf. So at this point, I think there's not really anything we need to do to protect those tonight.
And are there any plants that we need to, are there any things that in particular, anything particularly sensitive that people might want to think about versus tulips versus maybe some fruit trees? What are you thinking, Rhonda?
Well, the one that we're concerned the most about at this point across the state and certainly in southern Illinois are the peaches. And the blossoms come out before the leaves, and they come out fairly early, and they're pretty sensitive to freeze temperature. So I've got a chart that shows, you know, all the different stages of the bloom as it comes out, and I think in most cases we're, you know, pretty, in this part of the state anyway, they're just starting to show a little color. And so at that point, we'd probably lose about 10% if it got down to 20.
And what about apple trees? Is that something? I know those are pretty common in Illinois. I mean, when you're thinking about lower yields, does this up and down temperatures this early in the year have an effect also?
Well, it's similar on apples. The apples, the leaves start to come out a little bit before the flowers, and again, the leaves are a little bit more durable, at least in my mind, and so the temperatures that they can handle is lower, and certainly I think that most of the apples aren't out as far as the peaches. Now, I have heard that some people have seen their cherries are really starting to leaf out some, and so, you know, again, we could get some kill if the temperatures get down into the, you know, kind of high teens, low 20s. But I don't think there's a whole lot we can do about it. We're not going to lose the trees. We might lose part of the crop, but it should be fine for next year.
Mm-hmm. And Martha, when we think about this, I wonder if you can help us sort of understand from a plant perspective where the plants are with this, because it's been so strange. It's been so warm. When you have 70 degree temperatures in February, I imagine it's not what does it do to the plants? Are they kind of confused? They think spring's here? What happens?
Well, plants are going to respond to two things. They're going to respond to temperature, which we're seeing, obviously. But many of our plants also respond to day length. And our days are still short. So both of these cues are not being delivered. Now, some of the plants that we're seeing come out now, they have, it's called a chilling requirement, and that's the amount of cold that they need. Those are the ones that usually have a very short chilling requirement and respond to these shorter days. Some of the other plants that are holding off, they tend to come out when the days are longer. So right now, you know, the plants are confused, and you've got to say Mother Nature's in charge. And yes, you know, whatever we're hit with, the plants just are going to have to survive. We talk about, you know, cleaning out your gardens right now, and I think both Rhonda and I agree it's early, and, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. So I wouldn't recommend, especially in central Illinois and northern Illinois, to go out and start cleaning. Or if you do, I would keep a pile of leaves fairly close in case you have to cover stuff back up.
Okay, yeah. Rhonda, what's your advice about that?
Yeah, I agree with that. The other thing to consider is overall our winter's been pretty dry. And so especially if you have, you know, young trees or even some other plants that tend to be really dry, you might want to water them a bit. If we don't get any substantial rain, the moist soil is going to actually hold that heat a little better.
And Martha, are we at the point where people should be thinking about pruning, or is it too early for that? What kind of preparation do people need to be doing for spring gardening?
No, with pruning, this is the time that we recommend, especially on your plant material that drops its leaves, because you can see the actual structure of the plant. So, you know, February and March are always the times that we recommend. It's a dormant pruning stage. We're just in a year where we're having this unusual warm weather, but still, it's a perfectly fine time to get out. In fact, if people are itching to get out to do something, that could be a good activity for them to go and look at their woody plant material, see if there's any damaged limbs from the winter, any crossing limbs that are rubbing, or maybe they just need to thin out some of their woody shrubbery.
And Rhonda, what about for vegetable gardens? Does this early warm weather mean people should be thinking about planting those gardens? Can you start them earlier or not yet?
I think I would stick to the regular recommended schedules. You know, we have some crops that can take really, really cool temperatures, you know, our early crops, and then that kind of progresses till we get to the ones that can't handle frost at all, like a tomato. So I would stick to those usual, you know, what they usually do in a typical year.
So, Martha, when we're looking at the forecast, right, it looks like after tonight and tomorrow night, I don't know if you think we're in the clear in terms of, you can never say that, right? Are we in the clear for snow or freezing? It's still just March. If, at least I'm thinking about Formosa State, except for maybe southern Illinois. What's your sense of, do you even feel like, have you kind of given up as a gardener kind of predicting winter weather at this point?
Well, I jokingly tell people, you know, if I had a crystal ball, I would be able to, you know, predict what's going to happen. It's still early. You know, our average date of our last frost for central to northern Illinois is really the early part of May, and that's the average date, and that still tells us there's a 50% chance after that. So I remember, you know, sometimes getting frost toward, you know, May 20th. So, you know, who knows? And as far as plant material that's out there, there's really nothing we can do, especially if you're looking at your whole landscape, your entire landscape. If you do have some, you know, special plants or special perennials coming up, if we do get down below 20, then I would probably cover them up. But for some of our trees and shrubs, we just have to keep our fingers crossed.
And Rhonda, is it, I know the colder the temperature, the greater risk. How cold is too cold? 20 is okay, do we think?
You know, I need that crystal ball that Martha's talking
okay.
about, because every plant's so different.
Uh-huh.
You know, we have plants that are supposed to be blooming right now. Right now I have witch hazel blooming, my Linton rose is blooming, there's crocus up, my silver maples are in full bloom. And so, you know, those, go out and enjoy those, because those are supposed to be there right now.
Okay. And in terms of what everyone else should be thinking about, you mentioned in terms of people who want to get out there, if they're kind of itching to get out there, what do you think for in terms of weeding, what people should be thinking about, hand weeding versus chemicals? Where do you guys stand on that? Rhonda?
Yeah, it's funny. Martha and I were just kind of talking about this. Typically, you know, if we're thinking of lawn weed control, for example, the crabgrass, which is what a lot of people are concerned about, typically will germinate when our soil temperatures are about 55 degrees for 5 to 7 consecutive days. And so I went and looked at the soil temperatures just to see, and we've been above 55 in some places of the state, you know, for one day, but it certainly is back down in the low 40s in most places. So I think our weed control is going to be very similar. You certainly can go out there and start pulling, you know, some of those winter annuals. Again, like Martha said, I wouldn't take off too much cover, you know, the leaves and mulch and such, because we want to keep that as, you know, just to protect the plants. But you could go ahead and pull some of those winter annuals like henbit and chickweed that are coming up.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. That's Rhonda Furry. She's a horticulture educator at the University of Illinois Extension on the line with us from Havana. And I want to thank Martha Smith joining us from up near the Quad Cities from Milan. Ladies, thank you. Thanks for offering some advice for us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about a new baseball site that just launched. It's called La Vida Baseball, with its editor-in-chief, Adrian Burgos Jr. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is The 21st.
La Vida Baseball,
where our stories are told.
Describe my country.
Awesome.
It's beautiful.
My father and my two grandpas, they are my heroes.
We don't really have a glove until we're like 10 or 12.
Like this?
They always ask me, what's my favorite dish? And I go, arepas, and they're like, what?
Rice and beans, chicken.
Say pollo.
You just got to get a chance. If you get a chance, you fight for your dream, and you're doing the big league.
Our game.
Nuestra voz.
Our history.
Our story.
Tell your mom and abuelita about us.
All right, that's a clip from La Vida Baseball. It's a new digital media company just launched by the National Baseball Hall of Fame yesterday. Here's a stat for you since we're talking baseball. In 1990, 16% of major league players were Latino. By 2015, that percentage has doubled. And, you know, it's no question, obviously, that the Latino love affair with baseball isn't just with players, but the community. That's the idea behind this site. Its editor-in-chief is none other than Illinois' own Adrian Burgos Jr., a baseball historian at the University of Illinois. Adrian's in studio with me now to tell us more. Hey, Adrian, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me on.
So 54 million Latinos living in the U.S. Do you think it's safe to say that means 53.5 million are baseball fans?
Well, maybe not 53.5, but, you know, we have a young generation. They use social media, and this is where we think we can actually connect with them and tell them the stories, which are our stories. The stories of Latinos in baseball is about immigration. It's about migration. It's about acculturation. It's about assimilation. It's all those things. And so we get this forum to share those stories. And one of the things I love about La Vida Baseball is that we talk to these players. We talk to our legends. We go into the community about what life and baseball is about. It's not about what's going on between the white lines of the playing field. It's how do you live a life. They're coming from Dominicans, 16 years old, and how they grow up in the United States, and they form friendships and relationships with other Latinos. In many instances, it's their first exposure. And we heard some of the ball players talking about the different foods that they like, and you know, they're learning from each other because Venezuelans, they love arepas.
I was going to say arepas. It's such a Venezuelan thing. And then you heard the chicken and rice or the black beans. I didn't hear any. I'm surprised there was no Cuban black beans and rice in there.
Well, that's coming.
That's coming. It's coming. All right. And I was looking at some of the social media reaction to the site. A question a lot of people were asking, I was seeing on Twitter, why hasn't this happened before? So I guess that's my question. What was behind this is something the National Baseball Hall of Fame is producing.
It's in partnership with the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And to me, what was exciting, just down in spring training a couple weeks ago and last week, and I go up to Carlos Beltran, Puerto Rican player with the Astros, and I shared with him, this is the Hall of Fame reaching out to us, Latinos in the U.S., across the Americas, and the time is right because we have Pedro Martinez that went in to the Hall of Fame. We have this year Ivan Pudge Rodriguez. We have more guys coming, Mariano Rivera. Others are coming. This is the moment to really reach out. Why hasn't it happened before? You know, I think part of it was that the Hall of Fame had to engage in this project of education of its fans, and that was with the Viva Baseball exhibit. And this is the 21st century version, and it transformed now into La Vida Baseball, a multi-channel digital platform so players can talk and share and will be on social, on Twitter, on Instagram. And for me as a historian, it's about having the informing these stories through a historical perspective, but about how it relates to today and to the experience of these players. And it's a great way to engage the public through scholarship, through engagement of just everyday questions and matters, and have fun, because this is what it is for these players. I love seeing the players react to what we ask them, because it's about the life of a ball player and the culture around baseball.
And so can you tell us a little bit more? This is a digital media company. Is the site basically kind of like a digital magazine? Would that be a good way to describe it?
That is a perfect way to describe it. We are a digital magazine that have outreach through video. We'll have, you know, long, short form written content. We'll have social media in terms of Twitter and Instagram, kind of memes that we'll produce. We hired a Latino, Henry Pacheco, who's a UCLA grad. He's a film and studies guy, and he has experience with La Flama and a number of social media content. And again, the team we put together, myself, Clemson Smith Muniz, Henry, We're Latinos. We're bilingual. We can relate to the players. We know the culture. We learn more about it every day. And that's part of what this is about. It's about educating others and ourselves across Latinos and amongst Latinos, but actually broadcast it out. What the Hall of Fame is doing is saying, this is such an important story. We need to partner up. TeamWorks Media has invested in it. They believe in it. They've put their own money into it and said, this is the 21st century to get this story out there.
The site's primarily in English, or would we say the site's Spanglish also?
Well, the written content right now is it's going to be in English. But when we talk to the players, when I approach them, it's like English or en español, however you want to talk, we'll talk. And so a lot of the videos you'll see will be Spanish and English. And some of the players like myself will move back and forth.
Right, sure.
Because that's really part of the experience of Latinos in the United States. Over 60% of Latinos in the United States identify as baseball fans. But what's really amazing is that most Latinos consume their news through mobile, through devices. They spend 14...
And in English as well.
And in English. That's right. Exactly right.
Right.
So this is, again, a way to reach out to them and to engage them where they're at. And I think this is going to be why this property will be successful.
Well, and it's also from a business proposition, when you look at purchasing power in Latino households, this makes a lot of sense to be reaching out also.
Exactly. And, you know, this is where we're at. We're about reaching out, and this is both showcasing, but also, you know, marketing to the Latino community, letting them have a voice, a place, and a space. That's what La Vida is about.
And so you're launching the site. Is this the anniversary of Minnie Minoso's death, dying 2 years ago? How much of that was part of your thinking as well?
You know, I think it's appropriate that today we're launching La Vida Baseball because Minnie is La Vida Baseball. And his spirit, his character, that is what we want people to become educated about, to engage. And there are a lot of players like Jose Abreu today and others who live that story. And what I found really profound in talking to these players and even talking with Pedro Rodriguez 2 days ago in Cooperstown, the reverence they have for their elders who came through and were pioneers for Clemente, for Minoso, that is part of La Vida Baseball. There's this respect about the mentorship, the brotherhood, the family that helped players get to this point. And in my own biography, baseball has been family. It was my connection to my grandmothers. They're the ones who kind of turned me on to how to be a Latino baseball fan, not just a Puerto Rican baseball fan.
Yeah, what does that mean if you're a Latino baseball fan?
So I asked my grandmother, Mercedes, a number of years ago. I was still in college. Are you a Yankees fan or a Mets fan? And she tells me, I'm a Yankees fan, but I also root for the Mets. I like my New York teams, but I root for every team that has the most Latinos. Whenever there's a team with the most Latinos, that's who I'm rooting for. And I was like, wow, this is actually how I root for baseball teams myself.
And then you do this now too?
Exactly.
So who are you rooting for now then?
Oh, man. You know, it is so challenging because there's
I was going to say, you really, that's a tough one these days
to
think about.
And so many of these teams have so many Latino players. As you noted before, we have, you know, between U.S. Latinos and foreign-born Latinos, approximately one-third of Major League Baseball. And there are teams like the Seattle Mariners who have lots of Latino stars and up-and-coming players.
Well, I'm thinking about the Sox, right?
Yeah, the Sox. Well, and don't forget Javi Baez on the north side and Wilson Contreras. And you have Lindor. What's really fascinating about this moment and another part of our inspiration for launching La Vida Baseball is we have guys like Big Papi who just retired. We have guys like Mariano Rivera who just retired a couple years back and Pedro. But now you have this young generation of Francisco Lindor, Javi Baez, who are like the future of baseball right now. And they're exciting. They're leading their teams. And so we want to connect with their generation.
Well, in their generation, and I'm thinking about the Sox having the only Mexican-American manager, when you think about managers as well, Ricky Renteria, like that's, you're also seeing now an evolution in the sport of not just players and coaches, but in management.
Right. And, you know, we have ironically enough, I think more Latino GMs and managers at the moment with Al Avila and others. But yeah, and this is also part of the voice of La Vida Baseball is to speak through a Latino perspective on these issues. We see it in Clemson Smith Muniz's first piece, My Clemente, so that people can understand what Roberto Clemente means to him. Similarly, you know, what I wanted to get across in my launch piece that about stories to tell is really about this experience I had in Cuba, where the old Negro League player Lorenzo Chiquitín Cabrera, who was suffering from diabetes, he was convalescing from just having his leg amputated. I was trying to be respectful of his time and of his condition, and I did a very short interview, about 10 minutes, got him on tape, and I said, thank you, Señor Cabrera, for your time. He reaches out and grabs my arm and says, is that it? I have more stories to tell. And I was like, well, then I'm staying. And that is what La Vida is about. There's stories to tell, and we're going to tell them.
How much of these stories are stories that maybe were known in baseball, that maybe were known within the Latino community, but maybe are not recognized in sort of broader baseball American, the American culture?
Yeah, I think part of what La Vida does is give these players and their families a space to share these stories, both to the Latino community, but actually this is why the Hall of Fame is doing it, beyond Latinos. This is the connection between the past, the present, and the future of baseball. And, you know, I think what's fascinating is when I reach out to a player and say, you have a chance to tell your story. Louis Tiant, we just were with him in Fort Myers, and we asked, you know, 5 minutes of your time, you're a legend. His first answer took 8 minutes, and he just began to settle in. And so we had over a half hour with Louis, and he wanted to share his stories. And the ability to let a player share what they went through is such a powerful moment, I think, for them. Because I tell them, I'm talking to Yadier Molina, and I'm like, ¿en inglés o en español? He's like, ¿en español? All right, let's go. And that's fine, because that's where he feels eloquent in, and that's where he can really express ideas. And I'm sitting across from Yadi, and he's almost in a catcher's crouch on the seat, leaning in into the interview. He's just sharing what he has to say. And then after, when we're done, he's like, that was fun. Thank you.
Well, and I was going to ask you that, Adrian. Do you have a sense, especially when you're thinking about players, your ability to communicate with players in Spanish? And we think, like, we see this in coaching staffs, right? Like, they now have coaches who can communicate with players in Spanish, but maybe that doesn't happen as much from a media perspective unless we're talking about Spanish language media. So I also wonder, for some of these guys, have they even had a chance to tell their story?
You know, again, what's La Vida's doing is, like, we're telling them, we're going to translate this, we're going to put it out in English, but just tell the story in the language you feel most comfortable in. That's what they've lacked, really, and that's the space that La Vida Baseball is going to fill and is filling, because it allows the player to just share their story, and they're already gaining trust in us. What was really interesting, I had a mutual friend of mine and Louis Tiant reach out to me and said, I was talking to Louis Tiant on the phone about something entirely different, and he mentioned La Vida Baseball to me and how much fun he had on the interview. And I was just like, wow, Louis is talking to our mutual friend about La Vida already because of the kind of space it provides him. He's one of our legends. And sure, the Boston media knows his story and understands, in a certain sense, his story. But La Vida Baseball is about Louis Tiant. It's about Manny Manoso. It's about Clemente. And it's about Baez, Molina, Lindor, Contreras, all these ball players. It's about their families. I was talking with Ivan Rodriguez's wife and family, and they're like, wow, this is so needed. You know, and it's like, well, join in. We're La Vida Baseball. We're your home. Tu casa.
And it's live now, LaVidaBaseball.com. It's editor-in-chief, baseball historian. He's based here at the University of Illinois, Adrian Burgos, Jr. Adrian, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks
I should
for
say
having
gracias.
Us on.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us, whether you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest Illinois news. If you like us on Facebook, search for the 21st. You can comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.